Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice. So Mona, I know a lot of questions you probably get is, how long is this going to take? You know, what are the delays? Is that true? Is that accurate? Do you get that question a lot?
That's a huge question right now. There's a lot of people, I can tell you, Mark, overseas who really want to do EB5. But because of the length of adjudication times, it's just crazy. Some of the adjudication times, they are put off EB5. It's amazing. December 1st, 2018, USCIS had 13,125 pending I-526 petitions that had yet to be adjudicated. That was December 1st of 2018. That means there are already approximately 73,000 beneficiaries, and this is just, you know, an estimated number, or potential beneficiaries in the pipeline, representing over 7 years worth of EB5 immigrant visas. That's just EB5. We're seeing delays and issues across the board. It isn't just EB5. So with all of these adjudication delays, Mark, people are asking us constantly, what can I do? How can I move forward? Is there something I can file in perhaps federal court? And when they say file in federal court, really what they're doing is referring to what's called a writ of mandamus. And there is one person right now who is the expert in filing mandamus petitions. And we are very happy to have him on our show today.
That's right, Mona. Today we have Ronald Clasco, or as we affectionately refer to him as Ron. Ron has practiced immigration law exclusively for over 3 decades and is widely recognized by businesses, universities, hospitals, scholars, investors, and other lawyers as one of the country's leading immigration lawyers. Ron, welcome to EB5 Investment Voice.
It's very nice to be with you. Thank you, Mark.
Ron, this is one profession where we actually brag about being older. 3 decades? I've hit 2 decades of professional work, but you've hit 3.
I call it experience, not old.
Indeed. As for experience, Ron, I would say the last 10 years has been totally different to the previous 20.
Well, I'd say that probably the biggest change has been in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly in terms of our topic for today. The delays that we're going to be talking about, a lot of them have really reached unprecedented levels just in the last couple of years.
Right. This has been a huge topic for concern across the board for immigration, not just EB5. And I am aware that both houses of Congress have approached USCIS to ask them why, what are the reasons for the delays. And of course, now we have a new head with Cuccinelli and who knows, where are we going, Ron?
Well, it's certainly a good sign that Congress, in a bipartisan way, has recognized the problem. There were actually 19 Republican and 19 Democratic senators
right,
who signed on to their expression of concern to the Immigration Service. The House on July 16 had a hearing on USCIS delays. The bad news is the delays are getting worse. The good news is that Congress is paying attention to it.
Well, yes, but we are concerned right now with EB5. I know that we can fight for delays in everything, but EB5 petitions, I feel, are a little different from other petitions because here you have people who have invested real money, real capital into this country. There's job creation issues, economic issues. And I feel that the delays of the adjudication has a different kind of consequence.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, EB5 is the poster child of the problems with the delays. So
right.
At the beginning of 2019, USCIS stated that its processing times for EB5 petitions was 21 and a half months. After that, they have now doubled it. They now say the processing times for 526 petitions is 45 months.
Well, Well, Ron, I'm going to blame you for this because you have been pretty successful in mandamus actions. And, you know, before we jump into mandamus actions, isn't this just a defense by USCIS because of litigation from people like yourself?
Mona, I do believe that certainly the main reason or one of the reasons that USCIS is now more than doubled processing times is as a defense.
Right.
Or an immunization against mandamus cases. I do not believe that it will be successful. I do not believe that federal court judges will say just because the Immigration Service has decided in 1 month the processing times have doubled, will immunize it against mandamus cases. So we certainly are not planning on stopping filing mandamus cases. And I believe that there will be a lot more filed by practitioners around the country.
Ron, before we dive too much deeper into this, could you explain to us what a writ of mandamus is, why it's important, and how it's used in the EB-5 industry?
Sure. There's actually two different things that when we file a complaint in federal court that we include. A mandamus is requiring a government agency to take action that they're required to take. I think everyone would agree that if you pay a fee to the government, if you're an EB-5 investor and you pay a fee for a 526 petition, the government isn't entitled to just take your money and do nothing. They have to act on it. And mandamus is the statute that says that you have a right to go into federal court to force a government to take action it's required to take. Now, there's actually, when we file these complaints, there's another section of the law that we also include, and that's called the Administrative Procedure Act.
I was just about to ask you about that.
Okay. Well, the Administrative Procedure Act says that you can go to court if a government agency has unreasonably delayed taking action on your case. So when we file these complaints, we include both. Even if the government tries to stand behind its processing times and say, look, your case has only been pending 3 years and we've now doubled processing times to 45 months. Even if that's successful on the mandamus, which I don't think it should be, I definitely think it would not be successful on the issue of whether the government is unreasonably delaying taking action. And for some of the reasons you mentioned, Mona, I think if you're an investor and you've invested that kind of money and your investment is creating jobs, it is unreasonable for the government to say 3 years or 2.5 years or 3.5 years is not sufficient to adjudicate the case.
Right. But we don't have any precedent right now as to what is reasonable time, though, do we?
And you never will, because it's a very fact-specific issue. So
right.
When we file mandamus cases, it's very important that there's a story. It's not just we filed on this date and it's been 3 years and you haven't decided and that's too long. I always tell my clients that judges are people and people react to actual situations. So every time we file a mandamus complaint, we have a story to tell about our investor and why and how the delay has prejudiced his ability to do what he wants to do, to come to the U.S., to start a business in the U.S., to put his children in school in the U.S., to open bank accounts in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just the fact that there's a delay, but, you know, I'm not really hurt by it. There's a delay, and here's how I'm hurt by it.
Right. Well, I have a bazillion questions that I want to ask you, Ron. But one of the first ones is, we have, for example, questions which come to us relating to this, relating to expedited projects. Now, an expedited project is a project whereby there's already an agreement that this particular project will be adjudicated within a certain period of time. But that's a discretionary matter. And if that investor has not been adjudicated within the expedited time, is this a case for a mandamus? Or because it's discretionary, you wouldn't be able to use mandamus?
First of all, when a project is expedited, there's no exact time. The government doesn't say, and we promise to approve every investor in 3 months or 4 months or whatever it is. So if you have a petition pending 6 months, let's say, I'm disinclined. I'm not inclined to take a case like that into federal court if the general processing times are 3 years or 4 years, and my investor is going to say, I want you to force the government to take action because my case is pending 6 months. So I'm not really comfortable with that.
And I agree. I agree, actually. Again, that word discretion comes into play.
Yeah.
Does it have to be something severe in terms of harm? Like, does it have to be economic, or could we just base it on humanitarian?
Yeah, technically, there doesn't have to be any harm. I just think your case is stronger when there is. It certainly can be economic harm. It can be humanitarian harm. We want to show that the investor is hurt, is prejudiced in some way by the delay. You know, that's not only for the judge. Remember, when we take these cases into federal court, we're dealing with a government attorney.
Yeah.
And the government attorney does not like looking bad in front of a judge. So if there's a story that we tell where the government attorney thinks there's a really good chance that the judge is going to say, well, why can't you get your act together to approve this case? It's been more than 2 years. The government attorney is likely to go back to his client, his or her client, which is the Immigration Service, and say, I think, you know, that the court is going to be unhappy that we couldn't get our act together in this. So why don't you just approve the case so we don't have to litigate it? And certainly in my experience, most of the mandamus cases that we file in federal court never reach a judicial decision. And in fact, before the government attorney is even required to file an answer, we generally get a decision on the long pending petition.
Well, this is something I really wanted to bring up. In our experience, whenever there's been a mandamus even threatened, it's not brought a decision, which I think is a mythbuster I would like to address. It's often just triggered an RFE. Do you have that kind of experience?
Yeah, well, certainly. The first thing we need to understand is when we file mandamus, we're not asking the court to get the case approved. The court doesn't have authority to do that on a mandamus case. We're simply asking the court to require the Immigration Service to adjudicate the case.
Right.
We have filed certainly many hundreds of mandamus cases over a lot of years. And I cannot think of one where the result is different because we did a mandamus case. In other words, if the Immigration Service is going to issue an RFE, it's not more likely that they'll issue an RFE because we filed mandamus. If they're going to approve the case, then the mandamus often results in an approval. If they're going to deny, then the mandamus may result in a denial. And there are some cases where we do mandamus where we're expecting a denial, but we can't appeal the denial unless they make a decision. So the only way we can get a court to review a denial is by doing the mandamus and then getting the denial. So then we can go to court and say, here's why the denial is wrong. So the key thing to understand about mandamus is it is very likely to result in a decision. The decision may be an approval, it may be an RFE, it may be a denial. And in our experience, whatever it's going to be, it will just be a lot quicker because we did the mandamus.
Which is honestly the result that you want.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me ask you this, Ron. Obviously, there's approvals and denials, but when you get an RFE because, I wouldn't say you get the RFE because you filed the mandamus, but you get it much sooner. What's the quality of that RFE? Do they often cite things that were included in the original petition? They're just throwing an RFE because they said, look, we did something?
Well, the RFE is likely to be the same as if we didn't file a mandate.
Well, so that's good.
Oh, yeah. You know, I see no difference whatsoever in the type of response I get to, for example, for an I-526 petition based on whether we had or had not filed mandamus. Some of the RFEs on 526s are well written and some are not.
Ron, when you say that, though, if any of our colleagues are listening who don't do mandamus very often, they will jump and suggest to their clients, perhaps you should do mandamus. There is a right and there's a wrong time to file mandamus, correct?
Yeah, Mona, that's actually a really good point. And it's an important point. We used to, previously suggest, and in some of the areas of immigration, we still suggest that you wait until your case is beyond published processing times. And that's always the safest. EB-5 has become an exception to that because the government has decided in 526s to more than double the processing times in a month. In 924 exemplar petitions, they recently, just this week, increased processing times to 85 months.
Which is ridiculous, which is crazy.
Yeah.
It's unreasonable, it's unfathomable, yeah. It's just crazy.
And in 829s, the processing times have gone up ridiculously, and there are all sorts of issues there with issues of, in some cases, people need to get the 829 approved in order to get their investment money back. So there are all sorts of things in EB-5, which I view as exceptions to the normal rules of how long I would wait to file a mandamus complaint.
Right. And would you suggest also that people who really do not know what they're doing stay aside from mandamus because a bad mandamus petition is worse than having no mandamus petition?
Well, yeah. So actually, I should mention one of the hats that I wear is as the chairman of the litigation task force of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Our major initiative for this year that will actually be starting very quickly is a national mandamus campaign to educate immigration lawyers on when you should and shouldn't file mandamus, give you the tools, samples, and things, tools that you need to do it, create a mentor system. So if you're not sure if this is a good case to file, one of our members will mentor you on our opinion on whether it's a good case to file mandamus or not.
Right.
So basically, encourage and empower immigration lawyers to feel comfortable in taking this action on behalf of their clients.
That's very commendable. I also often mention to our clients, you know, who ask about mandamus and what mandamus means, because our mandamus is a Latin term coming from we command. You have to have it as an ultimate. I would suggest very strongly that everybody looks at it as an ultimate, that it's not something that you can just do by and by. Don't just add it into your retainer agreement or we'll just file a mandamus.
Oh, yes. The worst thing that would happen is if everybody just files mandamus because my case is pending 9 months and I'm not happy, so let's do mandamus. Then you will start getting a lot of judicial decisions that are against us, and that's certainly not what we want.
Exactly. But what are the typical costs, Ron? Because I've heard costs coming from different lawyers from every end of the spectrum. I mean, I have my own idea of how much it should be, but I'd like to hear from you. What is the typical cost of a mandamus petition?
I don't like to talk about exact dollars, but I can tell you that there are lawyers who will charge on an hourly rate basis. I mean, there are, you know, big law firms where the, you know, the numbers can be really exorbitant. We now almost always do mandamus cases on a fixed fee. And the reason is we do so many, we know exactly what is likely to happen. And what we will generally do, Mona, is we will divide the fixed fee and have a certain amount for the preparation and filing of the complaint. And in most cases, that's all that's needed, because in most cases, the government ends up deciding the case before we get any further. But if the government decides to actively oppose the mandamus, which is, in my experience, in a minority of the cases, then we will charge an additional fixed fee, which will cover dealing with the government's motion to dismiss or the government's arguments as to why it shouldn't have to decide the case yet.
Well, the reason I'm asking, Ron, also is so that if somebody is considering filing a writ of mandamus, they have to actually look at whether or not they can afford it.
Yeah.
It's not an inexpensive motion. Let me put it this way.
Yes, but it's also, depending on who's doing it, the fee can be reasonable because it is something, you know, with the right law firm that they've done frequently, and they don't have to start from scratch.
Right. Economies of scale. And also time is money, right? Wait for your petition to be adjudicated whenever they get around it, or perhaps budget in for the writ of mandamus to, well, speed things along.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ron, are we looking at any major actions against USCIS relating to the current processing times?
Yeah, well, at least at this point, I'm not aware of any sort of a class action or nationwide impact litigation. What I expect will happen is something similar to what happened with adjustment of status and naturalization applications about 7 or 8 or 9 years ago, when there were many hundreds of mandamus cases filed in federal court around the same time, because the delays in adjustments and naturalizations had doubled and tripled for reasons relating to FBI check delays. And the end result of that, with some pressure from judges and U.S. attorneys' offices, the Immigration Service had to get its act together. Yeah. Rather than spending all of its time defending cases that were indefensible in court, they decided it was much more efficient to figure out a way to adjudicate the cases. We are certainly hopeful. I mean, the goal of filing mandamus cases, I'd say there's two. You know, one is, if I have a client and the client's goals and reasons for filing their petition are being thwarted by the delays and they're really being prejudiced, I want to be able to help my client. I'm not comfortable saying, so sorry, there's nothing I can do to help.
Right.
That's one of the reasons. And the other reason is we hope that by filing enough of these, not frivolous cases, but cases that are really delayed too long, that the government will do what they did in the adjustment of status and naturalization cases and decide that it makes much more sense for them to adjudicate the cases than to defend the cases in court.
Ron, let me ask you this. You've mentioned your clients, and I assume that means the investors, the ones that are actually filing the 526s on behalf of themselves and their family. And you've done hundreds of these mandamus type cases in order to, well, reach a decision as quickly as possible. Would it be possible for, say, a project regional center to hire you and say, look, we have these 20, 30 pending 526s. We would really like a decision, not only to benefit the investors, but to fund this project, to go back to that economic story that Mona was saying.
Well, Mark, you're actually asking who are the parties, I think, who could file mandamus.
Well, yeah, if you want to be all concise about it.
There are a number of examples where we have done just that, where the regional center sponsored and paid for the litigation on behalf of its investors. And all of the investors that agreed to be plaintiffs were listed as plaintiffs. And the regional center itself also agreed to be a plaintiff. So the regional center does not have to be a plaintiff. If you're filing a mandamus for 526 delays, certainly the investors are the proper parties, but the regional center, you know, has an interest in this also and can choose to be a plaintiff. And I've never seen the government try to move to dismiss the regional center as a plaintiff. But certainly regional centers sponsoring and funding the litigation for its investors is very common.
Now, there's one other issue I'd like to bring up here. We have seen, and we do know, that USCIS took into consideration cases where there was, especially in the Chinese cases, where there was retrogression. It did make sense for a lot of cases not to be adjudicated, because once they were adjudicated, the clock started ticking on age-out children. So there were requests which went out asking USCIS not to adjudicate Chinese cases. Unfortunately, we've got quite a few projects where they haven't adjudicated. It's been almost 3 to 4 years. It feels like, you know, USCIS took a blanket decision not to adjudicate any Chinese cases on some areas.
Yeah, so I think that the Chinese quota backlog cases, just looking at them in isolation, are not the perfect cases to do mandamus.
Right.
Because of what I said before, which is, well, what exactly is the prejudice to the investor if they're in a 10-year line? Why does it matter if the petition is approved in 2, 3, or 4 years? They're still going to be in the same 10-year line. And unless I have a good answer to that, sometimes I will prefer not to file a mandamus. However, in some cases, there are good answers to that. I mean, if I've invested money, it's certainly very relevant to me whether I'm going to get a green card eventually. And I don't want to wait 10 years to find out if I'm going to get a green card. I may understand it's going to be a long wait until I get a green card, but I have a right to know if my case is going to be approved or not. And if it's not going to be approved, well, maybe I want to get my money back and maybe I want to invest somewhere else.
So, right.
You know, there certainly can be situations. Now, another thing that's interesting is the impact of the new EB-5 regulation. You know, we know that one of the important elements of the new EB-5 regulation is that if you get an approval of your I-526, then you can retain your priority date if you file another 526 petition.
Yeah, that's part of the new regulations, not yet.
Yeah. So therefore, that's relevant to mandamus because, you know, if I'm, for example, a Chinese investor and I'm looking at a situation where I'm not really, for whatever reason, I may want to file another 526 petition. I'm concerned that the regional center may get terminated at some point. I'm concerned that there may be changes in the project. There may be 100 reasons why I may want to file another 526 petition. I can't do that unless my original 526 petition is approved, or otherwise I would lose my place in line. I'd lose my priority date. So the new regulation may give another reason why an investor may want an approval of his petition and may need to file a mandamus, even though he's in a quota backlog.
Yeah, Ron, for mandamus, you are supposed to have exhausted other remedies and there really should be no other adequate remedy available. Would the ombudsman be considered adequate remedy or another remedy?
Yeah, so the answer is yes. There's no exact rule of what remedies are available. Interestingly, the fact that the Immigration Service is now saying on 526 is that you can't even inquire for almost 4 years.
Is
kind of helpful in showing a court, well, you know, and usually we will do that. I mean, we will send something, we will send emails, phone calls, ombudsman, congressman inquiries, whatever we can do to show a judge, hey, the first thing we did wasn't just going to court. We are only going to court once all other options were proven to be impossible. But certainly the fact that the Immigration Service is saying you can't even inquire for almost 4 years is helpful in that.
That makes sense because you want that story to focus on the government attorney. So when the federal judge asks you, what did you do? And you're like, well, we've called, we've emailed, here's everything. The federal judge basically has no option other than to look at the government attorney. It's like, well, what are you guys doing?
Exactly. Yeah.
Ron, for these kinds of actions, you know, we have to sue. There has to be a plaintiff and this defendant. And obviously, we discussed plaintiff. For the defendants, what if it's actually a security check delay? That's not USCIS. Who would you put in as the defendant?
Yeah, so we'll usually include, and there's really, this is not as big of an issue as it seems. And different lawyers include different parties as defendants. And with the present administration, the hardest part of these sometimes is to figure out who's the head of which agency because they change every other week. But we generally will include the director of the USCIS, the director of the investor unit, often the director of DHS. If we know that the reason for the delay is an FBI security check, we may include the director of the FBI as a defendant.
But what if it's an issue relating to the consulate, which we are facing a lot of now because of administrative processing delays?
Yeah. So this is actually an interesting area. It is possible to file a mandamus case on a case that's pending at the consulate. The reason this is interesting is because many listeners may know of something called the doctrine of consular non-reviewability, which is, as a general rule, if the consul denies a case, it's usually not reviewable.
Right.
That's the Supreme Court precedent on that.
And but they usually send it back to USCIS if they deny a case.
Yes, and then it may be reviewable depending on what USCIS does.
Right.
So some people think that because of the doctrine of consular non-reviewability, you can't file a mandamus on a case that's stuck in what they usually call administrative processing at the consulate. And that's not right. You can file because you're not seeking a court to review a decision of the consul. You're seeking a court to simply force them to make a decision. And in most cases, federal courts will agree to entertain a mandamus case on a case that's pending too long at a consulate on administrative review.
This is going to be very, very important moving forward. Mark, I can just explain this to our audience as well, because we are at a turning point now for cases which are perhaps denied in the future and cases which would need refiling. You would fall back on both timing as far as maybe age out is concerned. Your child might have aged out as well as be backlog. Mm-hmm. But in addition, you might be looking at paying from a difference between 500,000 and 1.8 million. So I feel, Ron, you're going to be very busy moving forward.
Your prediction, I think, may end up being an accurate one.
I want to do something fun with both of you. If you'll head on over to Skype, where you see the chat window there. And I want to say this, preface this by saying, Ron, not all heroes wear capes. And when I think of what you're doing with the writ of mandamus, as well as leveraging the Administration Procedure Act, okay, both Ron and Mona are laughing. So I want to describe to our listener what just happened. I superimposed Ron's head on a popular, very fast-running DC comic hero with his fist wound up, ready to punch. And Ron, as I was listening to you describe what you do for the EB-5 industry, using these tools of the writ of mandamus and the Administration Procedure Act, I can definitely see why your services are so much needed. I also want to say congratulations for winning the A-List Founder Award for the second time.
Well, that's really very kind of you to mention, Mark. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And for those that don't know, the AILA Founders Award is presented to the person or organization who has made the most substantial impact on the field of immigration law or policy. And I can definitely tell with the way we were talking about strategies in order to get USCIS to process these 526s. That's a big deal. And we're happy to have you on. Thank you for explaining it to us.
We like to keep our industry collegial. Right, Mark?
Yeah, you could probably tell by the little caricature I did there real quick. But Ron, thank you again for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.